Hello, this is Sharon Steitler, the bird chick, and I am here with non-birding Bill.
Hello.
And it is our gold podcast. It has evolved over the years.
I don't have a joke this time.
I know, it's just, you know, at that interview that we had a couple weeks ago where the guy was asking me, you know, how did the podcast start? And I was thinking of, like, my stupid dream when I first started doing this was me essentially reading the news 3 times a week, doing like 15-minute things, just not even necessarily doing some commentary.
And essentially, then just, Kids Beat.
See you next time on Kids Beat!
You were going to do the bird version of Kids Beat.
I'm Audra Lee.
And screw up everybody's TV watching by 5 minutes.
I wonder what Audra Lee is doing these days. I'll have probably to Google that later.
Probably working for Turner Broadcasting, I would imagine.
Is Turner Broadcasting still a thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're part of, you know, Time Warner.
Okay.
They're part of that whole AOL deal.
Oh, okay. Shouldn't she be, you know, talking movies with Robert Osborne on AMC? Wasn't that all part of...
Oh, yeah.
I'm Audra Lee.
So,
and
birds.
This week, so, birds. Actually, okay, so speaking of news, actually, and the first... So, my dream was that this was going to be, like, a news-type podcast.
Is this
going
to be a thing where we talk about your dreams and, like, what you wanted out of life and, like...
I actually really have everything that I want out of life.
Great.
I mean, I've got you.
Sure.
I've got birds.
Yeah.
I travel.
Okay.
I get to eat pretty much whatever I want.
Sure. Okay.
So I'm living the dream. I have an office that has dead birds, books that I've written, and fossils in it.
Okay.
I love that. I love Great. That. Anyway. But no, so my dream for this podcast early on was that this was... I dream the dream of podcasting. Yeah,
I was gonna say, I think we've covered rather extensively, you know.
What the dream was. Well, someone has realized it. There is a woman who has gotten a Canadian bird feeder company to sponsor a newscast, and it comes out once a week. It's called Brown Bird News, or BBN for those that are
Brown Bird News?
Yeah, that's a Brome Bird News, because it's Brome Bird Feeders. They make the Squirrel Buster and Squirrel Buster Plus. Right. It's a Canadian company.
Sure.
But these newscasts are delightful, because it's...
Okay.
It's this woman named Tatiana Thompson.
Okay.
And she has, you know, this nice Eastern European accent, and she tries to add a little bit of flair. But, I mean, she actually has really interesting news. Like, I was just watching the first one. It's like, well, let's see what a birding newscast looks like. And it's very professional with, like, a studio and everything. And then she starts talking about some news happening up in Saxon Bog. And I was like, okay, I live in the state with Saxon Bog. And I like to think that I have my finger on the pulse of the birding news here. How did I miss this story about... that was actually an interesting story. There's a company that's buying all this land up and around the bog. And they're going to convert some of the farmland that had been irrigated from the bog so farmers could grow things. And it hasn't really done all that well. So they're going to convert it back to this bog.
So that is fascinating.
But no, here's the thing. Companies in other areas that are destroying wetlands, they can help pay money to help restore the bog, and these are like credits. So you're destroying this wetland over here, but it's okay because you helped this wetland over here.
Oh, it's like wind credits for energy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And I have mixed feelings for it, because it's like, I don't want to tell some other wetland that has, you know, some cool, you know, some yellow warblers in there, you know, screw you, you'll find someplace else to go. But at the same time, it's like, well, this is going to benefit a lot of Connecticut warblers and black rails and all kinds of fun species that they have at the bog. But anyway, the newscast is delightful. It's called Brome Bird News.
Mm-hmm.
I heart this woman very much. You should check it out.
It's interesting that it's a video. It looks like it's set up like a news podcast. It's video, which is odd to me because so much is, you know, I just hear so much about podcasts these days.
I know, but I mean, she is really going for it. I mean, it is like a newscast, and they have some commercial things in it. Like there's this Canadian guy, and actually, what cracks me up is what is it, Dr. David Bird or something like that. Mm-hmm. And yes, that is this guy's name. So he's their expert. So they'll pan to him for an interview or to answer a question. He very clearly did this during an afternoon barbecue because he's wearing this very casual button-down shirt, and I'm sure he's wearing shorts, but the way he's sitting, he's kind of looks like he's just wearing the shirt, and you kind of see his bare legs.
Okay.
Don't trust him on his binocular advice either, by the way.
Oh, all right.
but anyway, watch it. Let's welcome Tatiana Thompson to the Birding News community. Check out her podcast on Brome Birding News. It's a delightful 6 to 9 minutes. She's just cute. Right. And I shouldn't say she's just cute, but I mean, she's delivering actual worldwide bird news, and it's fascinating. So check it out. And you don't get as much non-birding commentary as you do from this podcast.
You know, I can go away. I can go over and watch TV if you want.
No, you'll just because you're what the fans love. Everybody's like, oh, I love Bill. He's great. So, but no, speaking of living the dream, I now write for Audubon Online.
Good.
The National Audubon Society. And so what started as a conversation with one of my coworkers about things that kill hummingbirds, me just showing him all these gruesome things that hummingbirds eat. And then that night we saw this whole thing of this dragonfly.
Things that eat hummingbirds.
Yeah, that had killed a hummingbird. Sure. Yeah, what did I say?
Things that hummingbirds eat.
Oh, yeah, things that eat hummingbirds.
Sure.
So I was tweeting back and forth with one of the editors from Audubon. I was like, I'll write this up for you. I'm just like, sure. I literally got paid to write an article about all the things that kill and eat hummingbirds. It was fantastic. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, the editor even sent me a thing today. She's like, this is my favorite Facebook comment so far. Oh my God, not the hummingbirds. I love the little hummies. This was awful. I'm literally sick now. Mm. I'm in shock. That poor hummer.
Who doesn't love a hummer?
Eh. I can take it or leave it.
Yeah. I have stronger feelings on them.
I love that. I want to put that on my resume about my writing. I'm literally sick now.
It's next level bonkers.
How many people can say that? I wrote something and someone's like, I am literally sick right now.
There you go. That's, you know, well, speaking of dreams, that's always the dream.
I know, that is the dream. I'm just so excited. Okay, so we have to talk about some news. Last week, let's just get this out of the way.
Okay.
So, last week we talked about snowy owls. And I was having lunch with a friend the other day, and they work for a raptor organization. And we started talking about some of the nutty stuff going on with snowy owls. And I said, you know, owls are fast becoming my least favorite species.
Yes, I remember you saying that.
And it's just because you either see people doing stupid stuff, or you, either on behalf of the
owls. It's not the owls, it's the people who are watching the owls.
I know, and I just kind of wish the owls would go away. You know, like, and it's not even just the person who's getting way too close to the owl.
Right.
It's the person who decides that they are the self-appointed guardian of the owl. And
I would like to point out that I've been, as you know, for various reasons, I've been going out with you in the morning, mostly to spend time with you as you go to bird your patch.
He is not birding. He is just walking.
I'm
he is still non-birding
Spending time
Bill.
With my wife. And you have been complaining about owls and how you want them to go away on these walks. And then we took an alternate path because you wanted to check to see if there was an owl in this area.
I wanted to see if there was a sowet, because I have a hunch that a sowet is going to show up in this particular area. I just want a good bird for my patch, that's all.
Sure.
But
you also mentioned that if you found one, you would probably have to, like, what was it, set your thing to private, or, like...
I would either, if I found a sowet in our patch, I would do...
Our patch.
I got a sowet in my patch, baby. No, I would either, well, my patch is listed as 2.1 miles, and I would just say it's in the middle of the patch, so someone would have to know exactly where it was.
Sure.
So, and that wouldn't necessarily be easy to figure out. Or I would just post-date it, and I would just say that list is going to stay there until March, and then I'll post it in 6 months afterwards, which makes people angry, but it would depend on a lot of factors. Like, if it was a sowet that was hanging out directly over the path that everybody walks under, then I would say that sowet made an informed decision. But if it was one that chose a more secluded location...
Are they breeding now, or are they...
No.
Great, yeah. Look at me like I'm insane, because I didn't know what the...
What bird in Minnesota would start breeding in November?
Well, don't other owls, like,
great
hatch,
horns,
like, in the middle of winter?
Well, January.
Well, there you go.
That's a couple
I don't see
of months
what that's
away.
Insane. I'm sorry, that, yeah, here we go. That's
right.
That's why that was insane.
They wouldn't start now.
But I thought the thing was you don't want to draw attention to them while they're breeding, so they won't abandon the nest.
You don't want to draw attention to them while they're breeding. In theory, depending... Some owls, I feel, make informed decisions when they're roosting in the wintertime. You know, if it's an owl that... I know a spot in my park where I can fairly reliably get a long-eared owl in the wintertime. It is not an easy spot to pick out. The way I found it, actually, was that I accidentally flushed it. Mm. It was not a spot that I would think to look for this particular long-eared owl. But since I know that's where it can be found, I see it there. This bird really doesn't want to be seen, really wants to be left alone. And if you get, in my opinion, not even that close to the tree, it takes off. That's not an owl I'm going to report.
Okay.
But an owl that's hanging over or is perched over a well-trodden path... Sure. That is something where it's like, well, this bird knows people come here because people walk underneath here all the time. Mm-hmm. It's like a couple years ago? There was a group of long-eared owls, a parliament, if you will, of long-eared owls that were roosting in the wintertime in a heavily trafficked city park in downtown Chicago. It made the news. And it's like, okay, that particular parliament of owls made an informed decision. Certainly don't do things to harass them.
Why do you... You and other people seem to have this very, like, you don't react this way to any other bird, unless it's like a super, super rare bird that, you know, like, is completely off course and has never been seen there before.
I know, and it's crazy.
Why are owls that way? Because it's not that way with any other bird of prey.
I've actually been thinking about this quite a bit, because some friends and I have a running joke, you know, when people talk about, oh, you shouldn't bait owls, you shouldn't be feeding owls.
Sure.
But at the same time, we're totally thinking it's awesome when someone holds out a whole handful of peanuts and peanut butter and they get a boreal chickadee to sit on their hand. That's cute. And it's like, well, hey, you just totally baited that boreal chickadee to
one,
the street.
Well, one, with an owl, you're baiting a living creature and there's, you know, economics of energy that
so
this bird is
what
eating.
What if I just took a dead mouse and just kind of wiggled it around? You know, a mouse that was already dead that was meant to be food for something else.
Well, if the owl ate it, if the owl got to eat it, I personally would not have a problem with that.
And that's what some people say. And where I get weird with it, it's like, well, maybe don't do that to the side of the road. But there are people up in Saxon Bog who will go up with peanut butter because they know the boreal chickadees will fly to the road, and if you're still enough, the boreal chickadees will sit in you and it's like, okay, that's okay. You just attracted that chickadee to the road. And then I was also thinking of one of my absolute favorite places to go birding anywhere in the United States is Estero Llano Grande in the Rio Grande Valley. I've even dragged you there. And one of the highlights of that park are these birds called common parakeets. It's a type of nightjar. And they roost on the ground, and they roost right next to the trail. And the park rangers have done things like, you know, they have stick barriers. So someone who doesn't know the parakeets aren't there aren't going to accidentally almost trample them. And the parakeets come back year after year after year. And were you there when Clay and I found the one that had the two chicks?
Yes, I took a picture of that.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, these birds know this is a well-trafficked trail. They're used to humans. Mm-hmm. And parakeets are like owls in the sense that they use camouflage to stay hidden, you know, so you can get relatively close to them. And that's one of the arguments with, well, you should give owls their space, you don't want to stress them out. Mm. And it's like, well, why is it okay to do that to a parakeet? You know, they need to hide during the day. And it's... I'm certainly not saying if you see a snowy owl and it's letting you get within 5 feet of it that, yeah, hey, go for it.
I wonder if it's because owls are, you know, well, people know owl. Like, if you said parakeet to people, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. If you said owl, they wouldn't know what you're... It's like, and owls are actively camouflaging themselves as opposed to, like, a red-tailed hawk or an eagle or something where you can see them soaring in the sky in the middle of the day.
There's a lot of people who say they internalize their stress.
Sure. I mean, if owls had their way, you would never see the owl.
Yeah, and when I often wonder, how many owls do we walk by and we just never know because it doesn't fly off? I'm sure I walk by several, but there's also the whole issue of owls have their eyes right in the front of their face and it's circular, so that's one of the reasons why people think they're wise and like they know what's going on. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole mythos that seems to be attached to owls that aren't attached, that you don't get that attached to other birds. And I find it frustrating And it's just one of those things when I see arguments start to break out on listservs, you know, with somebody, or listservs, or on Facebook burning pages, like, oh, how dare you report the location of that owl? You know, now everybody's going to go see it, and I just, I'm like, do you know? Have you asked the owl?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, I guess, to a lesser degree, this doesn't come up as much. You get the same argument with nests, like raptor nests.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you shouldn't get close to the raptor nests, and people, of course, want to see them and want to see the, you know, the chicks and everything. But it's, yeah, I don't know why people are crazy. I mean, I like seeing owls. I think owls are very cool. But yeah, I guess you just don't see them.
You don't, but now we're getting to this whole weird area of all these birds that are getting urbanized. Like, we have that bald eagle nest. It is right next to the 35W bridge, just outside of downtown Minneapolis. You can literally bike and walk underneath this bald eagle nest.
Sure.
It is someplace where you would never expect.
And maybe that's part of the appeal, is that these animals are so skittish. They don't want to be. I mean, I've always
said
that.
But I'm saying we're now getting some of these species that are no longer skittish. They're like, bring it, humans, walk underneath my nest. I don't care.
Even owls?
I'm
just saying part of the appeal is owls don't want to be seen.
That is true. But remember that great horned owl nest that was at T.S. Roberts that was right next to the trail and used to walk? And, and I was like, that's an owl that made an informed decision, because that was a busy trail. And the number of condoms that I found in and around that nest, those owls.
Well, that's bad news for the owls, because, you know, they need to reproduce.
Yeah, wishful thinking for a magnum with an owl. But
ooh, burn on owl.
But
you get some angry letters from owls now.
I'm sure owls have perfectly adequate cloacas to satisfy their breeding.
You're making
partner.
It worse. Walk it back, walk it back.
But I feel like owls get rules that other birds don't.
Oh, I completely agree with that.
And I find it both amusing and frustrating. And it's one of the reasons why when owls...
How endangered are owls compared to other raptors?
Depends on the species. You know, there's spotted owl, you know. Mm-hmm. And in some communities, that's debatable.
Well, I mean, like the stuff that we have around here. Like, if an owl, like, let's say, like a great horned owl.
No, that bird is not endangered.
Okay, so if a great horned owl was scared off a nest, it wouldn't be a great tragedy. It wouldn't be like the last peregrine egg in the...
It would be like the robin that nests on your porch and you flushed it every time you opened the door. That's a bird that made... No, great horned owl, it... Mm-hmm. I'm not saying people need to go to a great horned owl nest and flush it a bazillion times.
Well, that's the other thing, is like people get so concerned about, how much protection do these birds need?
Mm.
You know.
But I think you can't apply a great horned owl.
Yeah. Well, the other rule, of course, is if these animals are nocturnal and people are active during the day, so that if you see this owl and you flush it, it flies off during the day, it's at a weakness to predators.
That's true for great horned owls, but snowy owls, they're active during the day.
Yeah, but you've been complaining about snowy owls big time, too.
That is my big complaint right now, is snowy owls, because there are a lot coming in, and I think my message with the last podcast was there have been some found starving, everybody needs to calm their tits. Right after that was exactly what I said, was calm your tits about the snowy owls. Right after that podcast went out, the very next day, Project Snowstorm did a whole blog entry that was their first blog entry of the season about the snowy owls.
Okay.
And it was, I had to laugh because they're like, yeah, we thought it was going to be a quiet winter because the last two winters were so full. And we were just having our meeting October 14th through the 15th at Cape May about planning the year. Literally, as that meeting was ending, all the reports started coming in from Michigan and Wisconsin. Like, OMG, 30 snowy owls, what are we going to do? And so they were kind of scrambling because, of course, people were emailing them saying, hey, what's going on?
Right.
What's going to happen? So they said, it's not unusual for snowy owls when they first arrive to wind up in wildly inappropriate locations. After all, many of them are juveniles and even adults.
Like spring break. I don't know.
Like, what's going on? I remember like the first time like I saw a picture of a snowy owl in a tree and I was saying, oh, that poor owl. My friend Mark Martell used to work for Minnesota Audubon. I was like, are you kidding? They probably come down here and they're like, this is great. I can see so much better from... We need this up in the Arctic. Why don't we have trees up there? But, so they were talking about, you know, that that's what happens. And it, they did acknowledge that a significant number of the early arriving owls in the Great Lakes have ended up with wildlife rehabbers, which have been reporting that many of these snowy owls are seriously underweight. Okay. This may be a clue that we are dealing with a different dynamic than we've had for the past two winters.
Okay.
In 2013-14, virtually all the snowies in the East and Midwest were first-year juveniles, and they were almost all uniformly fat and healthy, the product of a lemming boom in Canada and a highly productive breeding season. Last winter, the age mix skewed more heavily to adult owls. Many of them were second winter birds, so at least 2 years old. And while they weren't as over-the-top fat as the year before, their condition is still very good.
Okay.
This winter, however, they might be moving south in response to a genuine prey shortage, the kind of classic setup for eruptions by species like great gray owls and northern hawk owls. So, and it goes more into depth, but it's saying, yeah, a lot of these are coming in starving. But the other thing that it talks about that you have to take into consideration is that you're getting a lot of these young birds who've never really encountered cars before.
Right.
So they're hunting and they get hit. Sometimes they're exposed to a disease that they've never been exposed to before. And these are factors that can lead to them starving. Whatever it is, we'll deal with it. But it's not all gloom and doom for the snowy owl. And just calm down. Don't be the owl police in your neighborhood.
Sure.
It's already started, though.
Yeah, I mean, if we've got, you know, if we've had two boom years, I mean, eventually, I don't know. But, well, that's
why... I've never read about a three-in-a-year row type thing.
Well, that's why we need Project Snowstorm to do the science. And
I was telling someone the other day how grateful I was that Project Snowstorm started three winters ago. Because if this was the third winter and we're like, oh, hey, there's an eruption again, maybe we should research this. Just kudos to everyone that's involved with that.
Can people still donate to Project Snowstorm?
You can always donate. I don't think they have their active campaign where you get prizes and things like that. But if you have any money to give to Project Snowstorm, I have. I wear my Project Snowstorm hat with pride. Although everybody thinks, oh, you think it's going to snow today? It's like, this is a banding code for snowy owl.
Yeah, because people would know that when they see snow on a hat.
But the O has a big yellow owl eye. Yep, people would know
that. People would absolutely know that. What was your other shirt you had? Something like Colo or something like
Colo?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah, for Common Loon.
Common Loon, but we have a co-location.
We have a
light rail going on here.
Yeah, a protest going on. And so things you say, the protest signs are like, no Colo! Mm. And so I have this shirt that has Minnesota on it, and it's got the outline of a common loon, and underneath that it has the loon banding code, which is Colo.
Yeah.
And so, oh, so you're pro-Colo? Yeah. And it's Common Loon. Yeah. It's a really cool shirt that you can get from Ornithopolis.
Okay.
I cannot keep track of all these bird names anymore. I know the people who do them, and I'm always about to say their names. It's like, I don't think they...
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm pro banding codes on all my shirts. Nobody knows what they are. My Northern Goshawk shirt, which is one of my favorite ones, the no-go that I have from PRBY Apparel. Is that a car thing? No-go? It's like, no, it's Northern Goshawk. That's the white supercilium in the red eye.
Hey, guess what, nerd? Most people don't know what birding banding codes are.
A lot of birders don't know what banding codes are. And they get really angry.
A lot of birders don't know what banding codes are.
Okay.
Imagine how normal people feel.
Here's the thing, everybody. If you're tired of all the arguments about owls on your birding groups, if you just really want to shift the argument, just start using banding codes when you report birds.
If you really want to change the argument, go someplace where interesting people are talking and have a drink.
Hey, people love it when I talk about Wemmys. Or Wub News.
Of course they do.
Here, let's talk about Dick. It's one of the main things that I loved about, you know, doing my bird surveys.
Was Dick?
Like, I got paid an obscene amount of money per hour to write Dick on a lot of paperwork.
Good.
In all caps. There was so much Dick. I had so much Dick in Texas.
Great.
A lot of Dick.
Let's move on to the next story. And we're moving on.
Let's move on to the Birders Choice Awards for 2015.
Please do not vote for me. I've had enough accolades from being Birder of the Year for the American. Please just... Let's just move on, please. Let's just put that out there, first of all.
Okay, I love that you're doing... You don't know where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah.
The podcast has been... Or not the podcast. My blog has been nominated.
Excellent. I don't even write for it anymore. I'm so glad your little birding thing is working out for you.
I know. But no, seriously, this
is so amazing that you could do that and be a housewife. Where does she find the time?
I have my husband do it. So, the Birders' Choice Awards, it's a British publication for Birdwatch Magazine, not to be confused with birdwatching.
Right.
But Birdwatch Magazine has their Birders' Choice Awards for 2015, and I look forward to the day in North America when we can have these kind of awards, because, like, the one award is Conservation Hero of the Year, and one of the, you know, so you have, like, your Sir David Attenboroughs.
Sure.
But you have Brian May.
Oh, yeah.
And you have Chris Packham, who's a big celebrity. Ooh, Cecil the Lion. I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. Especially considering...
Why did you even bring that up?
I just now read that.
Yeah.
But they have you know, site of the year. So, you know the best place, like Rutland Water or Bempton Cliffs. They have Rarity Event of the Year. I love that. The Rarity Event of the Year.
Okay, so what are you nominated for?
Blog of the Year.
Okay.
And I'm up there with Birding Beijing. Sibley Guides. I'm up against Sibley.
Oh, okay. Oh, is that David Allen Sibley's blog?
Well, duh. What other Sibley would there be?
I assumed it was him, but I didn't know if it was his blog or about his books.
It is, but I mean, periodically he'll write an actual article on there, and when he writes stuff, it's...
Well, there you go. I'm justified then.
Yeah, yeah. Birding Without Borders, which I think is a great... Oh, wait, that's Noah Stryker's.
Oh, wait, let me walk that back here. Sorry.
I was thinking of a Middle Eastern blog. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
That's Noah Stryker's blog. That's the dude who's trying to see as many birds as he possibly can. The guy who just got his 5,000th bird.
In a year?
In a year,
like
in
that?
The world, and still has 2 months to go.
Yep.
But 10,000 birds.
Sure. So if people want to vote for you...
You just click the box.
Okay.
But I think you shouldn't vote for me. I think you should vote for Bird Girl, who is this 13-year-old chick who already has 4,000 birds on her list because her parents fly her all over the place. But she does a lot for conservation. I mean, she is the voice of young birders over in Europe. I don't think she's as well known in North America.
I'm going to disagree with you here because young birders would be in the 37 to 39-year-old range. So I don't even know how to classify her.
Honestly, because people think I'm a young birder, you're going to have to up 39 to 41.
Okay.
Actually,
we'll put a link up and you can go see all the categories.
One of the things, I was watching the third installment of the Brome Birding News today, and Tatiana was going through some things, and she was talking about young birders, and I was kind of half listening, and then she's like, well, if you want to find them, you can find them on Meetup. And I was like, yes, I've been saying that for a long time. Young birders are not showing up in the traditional spots older birders are. And then I thought...
Wait. Young birders are not showing up at 11:30 meetings on Friday afternoon?
Please don't make fun of places that hire me for speaking engagements. On the podcast.
Young birders are not showing up at Burger King to complain about not getting their senior discount? What?
I'm just going to say, if you're noticing that you don't have a lot of people under retirement age showing up to your bird club, you might want to look at the date and timing of your meetings.
They're not showing up at the retirement community center?
Anyway, these are cool awards. You should check them out. If you have a birding club, you should think of starting these kind of awards for yours. I really want things to happen. I really want Rarity of the Year to happen in the United States, or Bird Book of the Year, or Discovery of the Year. If I could do Rarity of the Year right now, I would nominate this guy on Minnesota Birding who got a fantastic shot of a deer falcon. And because deer falcons are really big, and if you're not used to seeing them, the guy was like, oh, I was just driving along and I thought it was a red tail, so I got a few pictures, and he posted it on some other group. He's like, yeah, here's this kind of weird red tail, and everyone's like, that's a deer falcon. And so then he posted it to Minnesota Birding, and when he posted it to Minnesota Birding, he highlighted it as possible deer falcon, and it is the most it is what I would call a textbook pose of a gerfalcon. Sure. I mean, you just look at it instantly and you're just like, that is a gerfalcon. That is just everything about the jizz on that bird is gerfalcon. And I just love it. Everybody's like, what? And it turns out it's a first county record for this gerfalcon. But I would just nominate that guy because I just love. I just love it says possible gerfalcon, and that is an undeniable photo.
My nominee for rarity of the year would be the peregrine falcon that was perched on a wire in our friend's backyard.
God damn you, Bill Stitler.
Which you took them to task for daring to assume that a peregrine falcon was perched on a wire.
In my defense, that was in our old neighborhood. Cooper's hawks were prevalent.
Yes, they were.
Peregrine falcons around Minnesota don't perch on wires. And so when they were saying, you know, this bird's chicken, I was like, that's a Cooper's hawk, guys. They totally perch on wires. That's what's in Uptown. And they're like, no, I looked in the book. I know this is a peregrine. And for every time I've had someone tell me that, this is the one time where it was actually true. And she sent the picture. I'm like, well, fuck, that's an adult peregrine falcon.
So you went over there and shot the bird.
So I sent the picture to my friends who banned peregrines in town. I'm like, you're not going to believe this. Neighbor was like, I have a peregrine that's sitting on a wire. And it's like, no, you have a Cooper's hawk. And they sent this. And all of them were like, that bird isn't banded. Where is it from? And it's like, okay, that's my one saving grace, is it's at least an out-of-state peregrine. That's. And you may live in a state where peregrines perch on wires. That's great. Our resident birds really don't perch on wires around here. And this bird is clearly not. And also, this bird only shows up at our friend's house during migration. So, anyway. Sure. Anyway.
But that's, I'm just saying, that's my pick.
That wasn't a rarity. That was just the one time someone said.
It wasn't a rarity. It just happened one time.
The one time when someone said, I looked in a book, and it was the.
What was the thing you told me, like, so long ago? Like, some birding classification. It was like. Like, rare is more common than
rare
uncommon.
But local? Yeah. Peregrines, they're rare but local.
Yeah. But uncommon is more rare or something?
Uncommon is more rare than rare, yeah.
It's like finding out the pre-Raphaelites came after Raphael. You are messing with my mind.
No. Rare means there aren't a lot of them.
Yes.
Uncommon means... So if something is rare...
I know what rare means.
If you know where to look, you can find it. If something is uncommon, it can be plentiful in other areas. Sure. It's just not supposed to be here.
Okay. All right, do we have another story?
It'd be like, you know, like the scoters we saw the other day.
Sure.
Uncommon. They're certainly not rare, but they're uncommon.
Okay.
We do have... Oh, this is an interesting story. Oh, we're going
we'll
from
see about
bird
that.
Watch to bird watching. Mm. Okay. Bird watch is UK.
Right.
Bird watching is US. So they had this really fascinating...
Oh, magazines. Okay, yeah. I'm with you.
They had this really fascinating article about West Nile virus.
Okay.
And that it caused large-scale declines in many North American bird species and rare ones. So when West Nile first hit here in Minnesota, yep. It was all about the crows, the blue jays, and at the time I used to be with the Raptor Center, so it was, I mean...
And human deaths, let's not forget that.
Did humans actually die?
Yeah, there were some, you know, I think mostly at-risk people, like elderly and things. But there were human deaths from
West Nile. Yeah, and I just Googled it, and yes, and so that part is awful.
That's fine, but this is a bird podcast.
Yeah, well, and the way I was dealing with it when West Nile first hit here was picking up injured birds of prey, like red-tailed hawks and great horned owls. Yep. And I just remember the Raptor Center just did this whole thing where they covered everything that wasn't moving with mosquito netting. And that was good because there were other rehab facilities that lost almost all their birds, all their education birds, to West Nile virus. I think the Raptor Center had one bird that came down with it and ended up blind in one eye, but... This article is talking about West Nile virus affecting bird populations that we may not have known about. And, I mean, we're talking about things like tufted titmice, we're talking eastern towhees, purple finches. And it is just really fascinating. So it says, some species fared much better than others. Roughly half of the afflicted species managed to rebound within a year or two. Ironically, the resilient ones included the crows and other corvids, yep, who were strongly associated with the disease. And I think that's just because they're so big, and you hardly ever see a dead crow. So when you do see a dead crow, and then when you see multiple dead crows...
Well, I mean, I know that, you know, there was a huge concern that, like, you know, this is going to devastate the crow and blue jay population, which not a lot of people were... Nobody concerned cares. About,
yeah.
Unless you like those birds, but I don't think there's any shortage of crows or blue jays.
I remember the first time we saw the dead crows.
Yeah.
That was at that cemetery. Yeah. But it said, but a second group has not been so lucky. Knocked down by the virus, they've not rebounded and seem to have suffered long-term population declines. Species that had significant effects but rebounded included field sparrow, western wood pewee, downy woodpecker. I didn't even know downy woodpeckers were affected. I mean, those birds are everywhere. Yeah. Red-eyed vireo, fox sparrow, which is that bird I showed you the other day.
Yep.
Wide-eyed vireo, spotted towhee, song sparrow, Carolina wren, yellow warbler, and northern cardinal. No clue that northern cardinals were hit that hard.
No, never heard that. People would have been very upset if cardinals had been affected by West Nile.
But it was interesting. I mean, that's still a bright red bird. You think you would see that everywhere, like you would a crow.
Yeah.
But now this is where it really, you know, baked my noodle. Species that had significant effects that have not recovered were purple finch, tufted titmouse, black-headed grosbeak, eastern towhee, wren tit, Swainson's thrush, warbling vireo, yellow-rumped warbler, yellow-breasted chat, American goldfinch, ovenbird, and gray catbird. And here's the thing that freaks me out is that I think about American goldfinch, gray catbird, yellow-rumped warblers. Those are some of the most common birds ever around here. And I'm like, how many goldfinches am I supposed to have? I feel like they're freaking everywhere.
I don't have a reaction to that. Where is this study from?
The article is from Birdwatching Daily. Mm-hmm. And this is from a study that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Okay.
Well, and what the authors did... Researchers did was they looked at banding data and significant declines in populations and reports when West Nile virus hit. But it's fascinating, and it really makes you think that, you know, we're seeing all these birds. You may see a lot of goldfinches, you may see a lot of catbirds, but maybe something else is going on. Maybe you should be seeing more.
Well, maybe it's a specific region that, you know, that they haven't recovered in.
You can read more about it, but I just found it fascinating. You know, you can't take those common birds for granted, and I do think about, like, titmice here in the Twin Cities. It's always fascinated me.
I wonder what would happen if, like, something, like, a virus came over that specifically targeted, like, an invasive species. Like, if sparrows, like, European sparrows, just were completely decimated. Like, what effect that would have?
That would be kind of devastating because the house sparrow is on the decline in its native lands. And I think we're just going to eventually become the stewards of the house sparrow.
Okay.
And you do kind of see that a little bit with the house finch. It's not supposed to be in the eastern part of the United States, so it's very susceptible to that form of conjunctivitis.
Okay.
But
you never see, you sort of never see that, you never see a thing that affects an invasive species, or I've never heard of it.
Well, I would think if something affects an invasive species, it wipes it out before it gets to be an invasive species.
Fair enough. But I mean, yeah, okay, anyway. So, all right, something to be aware of. Do we have another story?
I have so many stories, I'm just going to skim through them. Some wind turbines at Altamont Pass, the most deadly wind farm in the United States.
Yeah, we've talked about this. Wasn't this like the first big wind turbine? And it was just placed in a really terrible spot.
Terrible
it was
location.
Good for wind, bad for wildlife.
Yeah, this was the spot where it made everybody think, oh, maybe we should do some wildlife assessments before we put up a wind farm.
Yeah.
One of the companies that has some wind turbines there is shutting down operations. Part of this is because I think they're trying to avoid litigation from some... But 800 of the 3,000 wind turbines in the Diablo Mountain Range are going to be shut down. So it's not a perfect scenario, but it is a sign of the times that some wind companies are like, okay, I'm out. We're getting out of this.
Okay.
There's another fascinating article that birds assess risk before they decide to either cross the Gulf of Mexico or go around through Central America. And it's all based on how much fat they have.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It's an article
where they tagged several species of thrushes and some red-eyed vireos. They put little telemetry units on them and tracked where they went, and they also took measurements of their fat and everything by the time they got to the golf ball before they put the transmitters on them. So it's just talking about how birds, on some level, take into account the amount of fat they have, wind conditions, before they cross the Gulf. And birds that traditionally don't have a lot of fat, those are the ones that go around the Gulf rather than cross it. So.
Interesting. It would be interesting to see if they find some correlation between that and where the birds come from.
Mm.
Like birds that, you know...
Hermit thrushes in Minnesota migrate differently than, say, hermit thrushes in Ohio?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. Hey, science, it's interesting, folks.
It's fascinating, so, and it's amazing what we can learn. Okay, and then, I probably have another story, but I'm just going to end with this. Audubon is reporting, after 800 comments and still counting, the reasoning behind our kingfisher posts. So we talk about the mustache kingfisher, where someone who had been studying its population, studying the bird.
Collected the bird.
Collected.
Killed it.
Killed it. For scientific preservation. And the internet went insane. I knew, I think even after our podcast, it was still going strong. And I saw George Takei link to it. And I was like, Uncle George, stay out of birds. Do your naughty humor, but stay out of birds. And George's, although I don't think George writes everything on his social media. I'm pretty sure people are hired to do that. It was like, we don't know where to follow on this, but everybody's talking about it, so we're going to talk about it. And I was like, I'm not going to follow that. But basically, Audubon takes some of the comments out of the feed that represent some of the thoughts and says, we completely endorse why this person took this bird. Good. And then gives well-thought and reasoned responses to everyone's comments from, but the bird was critically endangered according to BirdLife International. Sure. It's because nobody knew what the population was, and it's on an island, so it's going to have a small population. It gets into the science, and it reads in a very approachable way.
Yeah.
If you are vegan and you are completely opposed to animal killing, you're still not going to be on board with this.
Right.
But if you are someone who always finds yourself with your group of friends saying, well, if you look at the science, and then you get angry where when someone says, I'm not going to look at the science... Science sometimes has to do some unpleasant things.
Yeah, that's good. Good. I'm glad to. I'm glad.
And it's
Audubon is sticking to its guns.
This is one of the best articles I've ever read. That talks about collection, and it doesn't do it well. Well, here's this response that came out in this paper that is 40 pages of really dry, hard to read words. This if you have a high school education, you can read this and understand it. And as I said, if you're someone who's 100% opposed to killing of any kind and you're a vegan, you're probably still not going to be on board with it. But if you are someone who's remotely reasonable, this is a well thought out, good article, and I highly recommend that you read it. I don't fault the guy for killing the kingfisher.
Sure. I feel like I don't want to make this a vegan thing. I'm not sure that, you know, like...
Maybe I'm not singling out vegans, because we know vegans.
Yeah.
There are people who are vegan for different reasons.
Sure.
There are some who just do it for health
reasons.
But
I'm saying, like, you know, I can see why someone like me, who's omnivorous, would be upset about this. But, like, if you, you know...
I feel like if you're omnivorous, you can't really get upset about this.
No, you can. Because, for as we stated, for the reason this was an endangered... For the reason I was about to express before you interrupted me...
Oh, like, you never interrupt me on this frickin' podcast.
That this is an endangered population, so...
But it's not endangered. It's just that there had never been the funding before to really research it. And this guy was researching it. And it's an island pop... Anyway. The density was fine.
Sure. But as I'm saying... But, okay,
good. I feel like if you're an omnivore and you're eating meat, you have less of a ground to stand on than if you're a vegan, and you're vegan because you're opposed to killing things.
So if I'm omnivorous and somebody shoots an eagle, I can't get upset about it.
Well, there's legality there. There was no legality with killing the mustache kingfisher.
He didn't have a good enough lawyer.
He needed Harvey Birdman.
Exactly.
What happened to that cartoon?
It got really terrible.
Okay. Anyway, I don't want to make a joke about birds dying for science. Well, I do kind of want to make a joke about birds dying for science, but...
All right. Do you have any more stories to discuss?
I have so many more stories, but I think we've talked long enough.
All right.
Oh, I do need to say this podcast is sponsored by Wildside Nature Tours. Are you looking for some interesting bird tours with some really cool guides? Namely, me. Check out www.wildsidenature.com.
Only two W's?
Who would only use two W's? That's okay. I forget what I was watching today, but someone was, like, reading websites or... and they mercifully had the websites go up, but they were doing the www.flap.com. But they would forget the dot between the www and the flat. Anyway. You're interrupting my ad.
I'm sorry.
For Wildside Nature Tours. Wildside Nature Tours, where they take you on all kinds of fun adventures, including Honduras in March. You know you want to come along with me in Honduras in March. Bring your smartphone, and I'll bring some adapters, and I will teach you how to digiscope all kinds of birds and wildlife. We will get a resplendent quetzal. And if you're really up for adventure, you can come with me to Israel in the fall, in November, and we will see some crazy migration.
All right.
And if you're thinking, hey, Israel, is that a safe place for me to visit?
As opposed to Honduras.
I feel like more people ask me questions about going to Israel. It's like, is that really safe? And, okay, remember when I first got the invite to go to Israel and we looked at the map and how tiny it was and where it was in the Middle East? When you get there and you see how it's positioned among the mountains and everything, you realize, oh, this is kind of like the Ivory.
I guess my reaction to that is a product of growing up in the 80s of Honduras, because I have not heard anything about Honduras in the news other than, you know, oh.
All I hear about Honduras is how amazing the birding is and how cool the lodge is at Pico Bonito. And I've met the guy that runs the lodge there, Adams. He's fantastic. He's the guy that has... the guy that's, like, watching all the bad movies all the time that you love, and I'm just like, look, he's watching this in his big ol' man cave movie room. You and James would get along great.
Great. Do I have to go bird watching?
You know what? If you want to come with me to Honduras, you could probably just stay in the movie room. You would have to come out on the deck periodically and interact with people, but you'd get to see howler monkeys.
All right. I'm down.
Do you want to come with me to Pico Bonito?
Sure.
All right.
All right.
Yeah. Watch, that's the only people that are going to sign up for that tour now. It's like, I came out here to see birds and complain about them with non-bird and bill.
Come to Honduras, watch bad movies with me. Do you have any more stories? Do you have any more things to discuss?
I have so many things to discuss, but...
because I'm going to do the wrap-up, and I don't want you to interrupt me like you do, like, 75% of the time.
But you think that's adorable.
No, I don't.
Yeah, you do.
No, I
need to pack for Texas, because I'm going to the Rio Grande Valley. I'll be there for a day for the festival, but I'm mostly going down to lead a tour for Wildside Nature Tours with
Greg
Miller.
What an amazing coincidence.
Anyway, do you want to come travel with me? Go to Honduras. Go to Israel. Really, seriously, go to Israel. Israel's really amazing.
All right. Okay, this is Bird Chick Podcast number 197. I'm going to say this again so my wife remembers it when she does the blog post. Number 197.
Black Franklin, you can see that in Israel.
I want you all to rewind this podcast 2 minutes to where I asked her if she had anything else to say so she wouldn't interrupt me while I was doing the wrap-up.
Jungle Cat, we'll see Jungle Cat. Rock Hyrax, you know you want to see a Rock Hyrax.
I can wait for you to finish all this nonsense.
We'll see something that looks like a coyote that everybody calls an Israeli wolf. We'll see a somber tit.